Larry Collins. Those of you that don't know me, I teach geology at Cal State University Northridge, and I'm happy to present to you my father, who was a research chemist at the Department of Agriculture in the soybean laboratory for many years, and he's been a consultant for a number of universities and a number of private firms and in relationship to all kinds of foods and grains. And I think all I'm going to do today is to be a monitor. He's more up to date on a lot of things that are happening in science and some of the new developments. Although Rudy Edmond, who's also a geologist over here, we may ask him to chime in. I know that there are several other scientists around here, and hopefully we might have a little time left that you can all contribute in your own specialties as to what's developing in science. So I'm just going to turn it over to my father and let him take off from where he'd like to go.
Well, I'm very humble. I'm out here not expecting to be on this discussion in any way, shape, or form. I came out here to sit back and heckle these folks that are up here, which is what I'm good at, mainly, just heckling. But I was on last week. How many of you were here last week when we discussed the food problem? We could just use our last week's speech. We could do that. It was my privilege to attend after the World's Food Conference in Rome. I attended the United States meeting in Kansas City just about a year ago exactly. It was in August, very close to a year ago, for 3 days when they met to decide what they could do as a group of scientists in 16 different categories. This was an energy and land use and cereal crops and beef cattle and all kinds of meat products and foods and legumes and nuts and just everything, including financing of these things, to decide what they could do. And the 16th category, as far as I'm concerned, was the most important one. What can we do to improve the efficiency of the food products? Now, I believe that God gave us these foods. They gave us the corn and the wheat and the rice and the sorghums and the soybeans, and God created these plants for us. But God created them a long time ago when they had to survive of their own accord. They had to survive, and as soon as they would set some kind of fruit or some kind of seed, then they would see to it that they matured these and replaced themselves. And for this reason, corn has the flowers. I'm going to talk about corn for a minute now. Corn has 6 flowers on each stalk. It can produce 6 ears. But just as soon as it gets 1 ear or 2 ears set, it immediately kills the other 4. And if you grow this corn plant in greenhouse conditions, under controlled conditions, we'll find this corn plant, as once it gets started, you can give it all the food and all the things it needs to produce corn. It won't produce anymore. It just sits there and wastes it. It wastes more than it uses. You can irrigate it and give it all the plant food you can find to make it grow. It simply loafs on you. And there are 2 men at the University of Illinois, they must be doing it other places too, that are working on this problem, and they have successfully caused the corn plant in greenhouse conditions, controlled conditions, to produce 6 ears of corn, its maximum. And it takes practically no more water, no more other things, only very slightly more of the other things than the corn plant will use when it's loafing. And the corn gives you back less than 0.5%, and this is not a good record.
0.5% of what?
In grain, corn grain. 0.5% in actual corn grain. God produces about 89% of the things that goes into this, and man produces about 11% of the energy that goes into this. And we have a whole group of other crops, and none of them gets up to 1%.
You mean 1% of the total
1%
energy use of the plant goes into the...
goes into the grain. If they are terribly inefficient. So for the for a starting point, let's get corn to double its energy usage and give it back to us. Instead of getting 160 to or 100 bushels to the acre corn, we can get 200 on the exactly the same water and the same kind of stuff. And the possibilities are tremendous in this respect of improving the food supply. Now, if it all happens at one time and we get 4 ears from each stalk, we'll have corn running out of ears, and of course they want to shut us down because we can't sell all of it. We have many weeds that are far more efficient than this, and some of you watch
many
this.
Weeds?
Many weeds are far more efficient in the use of energy. Way more efficient than the use in the use of energy. Way more so. I'd like to see this little lily that comes up through the snow. I'd like to run an energy, what it would be doing. How about that? That one that comes up like this. The usage of what it gets must be tremendous.
How do you double the corn? You were talking about you got, you know, maybe...
We will have to do some of this genetic engineering, where we have to change the genetic structure, because God made them with a protecting mechanism so that it wouldn't start out to fill all these ears. If it did, it would just absolutely run out of food and water and things like this, and so that it gets busy and gets in a hurry. And then we accuse it of being lazy, but a lot of people seem to think that there is no possibilities here. But this is where the possibilities are of increasing world food supply. Increasing the efficiency of corn, wheat, oats, rice, barley, all of these. Of course, God made these plants and put them here, and man has improved them greatly. But this is where we are in this respect. Then, what else can we do? We can improve the quality of protein, the quality of things. And we have insisted that the coal we burn be low sulfur. And the sulfur, when they cut out the sulfur and burning of coal at the University of Illinois, the farmers had to start using sulfur in their fertilizers. Can you imagine that? And before that time, they didn't have a deficiency of sulfur. Sulfur in coal. And sulfur that goes out in coal that supposedly pollutes the atmosphere is a plant food. And it's against the law of lightning for the same reason. It makes nitrogen and nitrogen oxides. And they come down on the grass and this is wonderful fertilizer. Yet if we put just a little bit out in our automobiles, this is pollution. It is, maybe you didn't realize that, but this is the truth. We get 6 or 7 pounds per acre where you have lots of good lightning in a season from the air. God makes it this way. And this type of thing is going on. And I could mention a lot more. If we want to discuss here, we'll discuss and then we'll go on. Anybody want to make an observation? God made what he gives us and he makes it, and all of God's creations are good. And don't you forget it, the sun up above us here is a radioactive fusion process going on and on and on, and it comes to us 100% for free. And right out here, right now, if you put a square yard out here, you would be getting probably at this latitude at least 800 watts per hour, or more than 1 horsepower per square yard if you knew how to use it. Why not use it for what God gave it to us for? Now, where do you folks come in? You've got some grandchildren and some children somewhere along the line. We need some way of storing this power. We need some way of getting this power usable. Now, we can put out solar cells, and solar cells are very, very inefficient. I don't know, have you seen any lately, Larry? You seen one of these little silicon things? And they probably must be some physicists in here someplace. In this place, we can tell you a lot more about it than I can, because I work with Ansel Anderson and his PhD students on it. And he takes these cells and makes them. He gets one about 3 inches in diameter like this and puts it out in the sunlight, and it gave him 0.2 watt. And I think it was 0.4 of a volt. This is volts and watts, and this is power, and electric power, similar to what you get out of your electric lights. And they started to see if they could improve this. And by putting americium-241, which is one of these terrible waste things that come from this atomic power plants and so on, americium-241, putting just a trace of this on, he got this multiplied by 10. And he has calculated it by computers and so on, that he can get it no higher than about 20. Multiply it by 20. He can't multiply it by much more than that. Then let's put this into a battery. And Edison made the battery, didn't he? He made this one that we use, this lead storage cell. Works so good that we just quit working on batteries until just maybe 15, 20 years ago. And we've got a lot of different kinds now. And they're heavy, and we could use electric power to push. We got a cart around here. I don't know how many batteries it's got in it, but it gets around pretty well. You use it on the golf courses and things like this. And way back when I was a very young child, I saw some, what do you call them, electric, Stewart Electric or something like this, and you ladies drove them around. You probably had one someplace and know about them. But batteries are so heavy. We have to get a better battery. And where could we get a better battery than to have one that has just a little of this waste product you're talking about? Could be in such a small amount, but we have more than 1,000,000 volts. Put it in this battery so that it is superconducting. You've heard of superconducting magnets maybe somewhere along the line? Why not use some of this material and work to make a better battery? And such work is going on. Now, they don't know how to do this yet. And what can you do about it? You can get busy and support them. And I don't know a single scientist who can say, I'll guarantee you a battery next year if you give me unlimited funds. And I don't think it's possible. Neither can they give you a superior plant in that length of time. But give them that steady support that they need. Let's give it to them by legislation of some kind. Let's keep these youngsters, and it's the young people that you, your grandchildren, that are going to do this for us. I don't think I'm going to get it done, and I'm Father Time done caught me, as you can guess. But I still enjoy it tremendously, working with the people who are trying to do these things. And I appreciate it when they call me up and say, this is what we're doing, and this is what it's all about. Now, we're the endangered species, as you well know. We spend $102 billion. Seems to me that was the budget, wasn't it, for military?
At least that.
And we can't cut off making these military things, because the fact that we can kill everybody in the world 30 times over, but we would lose an awful lot of jobs. Why can't we find something else to do with these people? We can't.
That's welfare.
That's welfare.
Can't do that. Work for the military. That's free enterprise.
That's free enterprise. But it's welfare if we get them to do this. Well, we have power. And Kenneth Andrew told me just recently, and I also talked to a man that's out at Los Alamos, has been out there since they started working on the bomb project. He's been out there all this time. He said that God doesn't have to have the high temperatures and the high pressures to make some of these things go together. All we need to do is find out how to use the power of the hydrogen bomb in small enough quantities so that we can release it in smaller amounts. And when we get this, and we're going to get it, then we can use this power in small enough amounts so that we don't get the extremely high temperatures that create this pollution of the atmosphere with these poisonous wastes. Then we can start out, and if we can get a bunch of young people up in Canada, that we want some of your snow water up there, and let's reverse the Red River Valley and put some water in this area where you're burning up now. Aren't you burning up out there now? Yeah. Let's reverse the flow. And let's use all these people that are now making these military things. If they must have a job, bring them up here and let's start going on it. Bring it on down here and put them on irrigation. And then who owns the land that we bring the water down for? The people who are now on it? Or shall we charge them just a little for doing this for it? Is it reasonable that we ought to?
This was fascinating the other day when he talked to me about this business of reversing the flow of rivers.
Russia is doing it now in one of their rivers. And we can't let Russia get ahead of us, can we? We can't do that, can we?
Yeah. An interesting illustration of this in Japan that we just observed, and really the mass transit train. You see, after World War ended, the Japanese were not allowed to use their engineers in building airplanes and in building that kind of transportation, which was really essential for the war. So they put them all to work building trains. Not all of them, maybe, but at least they concentrated on that effort. And now they really have a mass transportation system that I'm convinced works. We rode the bullet train and all of the other electric trains. They're real people movers.
Just on the ecology, coming back to rivers again,
okay.
There'll be a great scream if you start doing any of this stuff in terms of wildlife and upsetting the balance of nature and all of this. If you're going to run that water down into Larry's district in South Dakota and you're growing corn and everything else down there, what happens on the other end of it?
What happens when we upset the ecology a bit and some of these endangered species? I don't know what any of you know Poco Frazier at Kansas University, who was the curator of the museum and so on. I had a chance to ride with him once, and he told me that the endangered species idea, God took care of that rather effectively way back there, and he eliminated 80 bigger of the various animals on the earth in all in one swoop, I think pretty largely this, that were larger than our elephants by a great deal of the, around 10,000 of these, but 80 of them that were much larger than our modern day elephants. And he eliminated all of those, and plus thousands and thousands of reptiles and things of this nature. And he did it so fast that the tropical conditions that were in the Arctic at the time, they have cherries below, cherry trees growing with cherries on them north of the Arctic Circle, and they found some of these frozen in the ice. It must have frozen up with the food still in their mouth. And I have to figure out how that you can change the temperature of the earth that fast. Have you got an answer for that? There was one in a theory in the, what is this, Weekly Science thing? You haven't had a chance to read your Weekly Science. Did you read your Weekly Science? Okay.
I've been here 6 weeks. I don't know what's going on.
I happen to know Baumgartner, who is, by the way, I'm going to talk about Baumgartner and David Kingery pretty soon, Faye, and then you can tell us all about them. Okay. Well, anyway, the theory is, present one is, that this galaxy in which we live, with all its moon and stars and things that go around here, is floating out through space. And the reason for the theory was based on the core samples that came back from the moon, and Baumgartner is working on these, and they're finding that some of this is stratified difference in layers. They think that we moved out into space into a very dusty filled space, and these were not large meteorites, but tiny ones, this just dust. And they shut the sunlight off, and how long would the sun have to be off for it to go below zero here?
Not very long.
Not very long. It went off so fast that it killed some of these very large elephant-like creatures with the things in their mouth. If this happened, then the moon has this dust, and it has no wind to blow it around. It has nothing more than meteorites and things coming in to strike the oven, stir it up, and keep it stirred out. So I'm following this with a great deal of things, because they're down through about five layers, and they think this has happened at least five times. How many ice ages have we had?
Recently, five times in the last 2 million years, with the several other ice ages. As you go back.
Well, they haven't got all the way down on this core yet. Supposing we do lose a few endangered species, so how about this God of ours? Can he take care of that?
I'm like a maid.
You're the man that was the minister this morning. We must have some more here.
It's time for God to do that. So when we start playing God, we don't have all the paths.
We are not playing God.
When we reverse the river.
When we are taking care of God's creatures by reversing a river to improve the health and the food quality for the people of the world, I don't think we're playing God. I just have to disagree with you. Go ahead.
What if I just use an illustration? There was in all of this, we are in all kinds of ways, I suppose, minor ways or major ways, doing this kind of thing. But I read a story one time that they were planning, I think it was a time when they were getting ready to dig the Erie Canal. And they had a big community meeting about this, and somebody got up at that meeting and made a big speech about how if God had wanted that canal to be there, he would have put it there himself, and that this was the wrong thing to do. This was in no sense playing God. And somebody got up and opened the Bible and read just those words out of the Old Testament, and Jacob dug a well. It seems to me it is questions of degree. It seems to me that we are given this creation, we are to use it and to be stewards of the creation and so on, and that maybe we should not reverse a certain river because of its effects. But it seems to me from that kind of theological perspective, That river also is part of our stewardship, and whether it's reversing a river or digging a well or building a dam or some of these things, all of these have effects upon it.
Well, it's a matter of using another of God's creation, and that's man's mind.
That's right.
Yes, and the greatest resource we have is the man's mind, and the young people that we have, and all of you, and the only hands that God has to work in here are yours and mine. And all of the grad students that I've spent years with over the years working with, they have immediately found out where I stood on this, that if you're going to get anywhere in this research, you're going to search for the truth, and it's going to be followed. When God smiles on it, it goes. And these hands of yours and mine are the only hands other than accidental. I don't know, not accidental either, because God doesn't work by accidents. He works by miracles. But God wants these things to be revealed, and we should use we got some talents.
It is abundantly evident that man can do great works within the will of God and in carrying out God's will on earth. It is also abundantly clear that man has the power on earth to work against God's will to the point of driving God to absolute frustration with him. And God has registered both his approval and his disapproval in history as man has worked for him and against him. There is nothing that we have that cannot be turned either toward or away from God's will. And this goes as well for the great powers that man has for anything else. We can't justify what we do because God has given us the power to do it.
You are so right. You must have somehow find out what is the will of God, and you're going to have to take some risks.
Well, you had a comment.
Well, on that same line, the problem, as was mentioned earlier, is the absence of paths. The human mind has failed so often in the past to have all the facts in the case and has acted on partial knowledge. And I guess the plea that I would have always is just to be careful. And if you're going to reverse the river, who knows what it's going to do? There was a conversation I had some years ago about using thermal energy from around Yellowstone. And okay, it would be a great source of energy, but it would shut down all the geysers. And that would shut down a lot of pleasure that people have. The same thing with endangered species. That there's a great pleasure derived from having certain animals around. And maybe it doesn't matter, you know, in terms of absolute values, whether or not that creature is killed off. But it's a diminishing of our own pleasures.
I fail to see where reversing one river would take care of a species, but maybe it will.
Well, perhaps not. But then, you know, we don't know.
No, we don't know this. There's so many things that we're going to have to let God take care of. But I think that God expects you and I to do those things with our hands which will make this a better world for the people that are in it.
Larry?
I'd like to go back to your beginning discussion, if I might, just a little bit, when you talked about increasing the efficiency of food production. I'm certainly a part of this and I'm well aware of that plants are very efficient and inefficient, and et cetera. The point I make is that as soon as we do double or quadruple the ability of the corn plant to produce grain, I don't see that that speaks to feeding hungry people, because the supply is only a part of the problem. We have to figure out a way of hungry people being able to acquire. And as I see it right now in the world, and it may be a short-term thing, we have the oil-producing nations accumulating all the dollars. And we have the United States is one of the tremendously capable countries producing food. And then we have underdeveloped nations with mass starvation. And some kid has got to come through a algebra class with a new mindset that we have not yet been able to come up with that says, hey, I got a formula how you can make all that work. All the elements are there. The dollars are there to help so that I, as a farmer, can afford to produce the grain. And the hungry people are there to eat it. We got to figure out a formula that puts it all together.
If we give them, if we give the family a fish, they eat for the day. If we teach them to fish, they can eat the rest of their life. If we teach them to raise the crops in these countries, and this is the only way it's going to work, we're going to have to take the knowledge and the seeds and the young men and women to this place and teach them how and convince them that this is a better way of life. It's got to be that way. You aren't going to raise the food in one part of the world and transfer it to the other part to feed these people.
Well, do you feel that all parts of the world have the capability of producing the food that they need?
Not entirely all of it, no. But they can produce and they're going to have to somehow learn to limit their population and learn how to take care of themselves, because this is simply an impossible thing to ship them food unless you ship the men and the trucks and the distribution system. After you get there, it doesn't get to them at all.
I would like to know how in the world, for instance, in a country like India, where part of the problem seems to be even their culture and their religion, you know. I mean, if they say when they, I don't know this for sure, I've never been there, but they say they ship grain over there and the rats eat more of the grain almost than the people. And then they have the Hindu religion, you know, where they...
Yes, I know. We have an Indian here. Is,
yeah. He Dr. Was Daniels here. Was here at the first session. Are you here?
I don't think he's here, but Dr. Daniels from India realizes their problem very well and knows that it's a matter of education and changing things in India. And this is not a short-term deal. You can give them food and keep maybe prevent them from starving for maybe a short time. But this is not the long-term solution. The long-term solution is to get them to grow their food. I don't know what kind it's going to be. I simply am not that well informed.
You mentioned, before we leave this thing on the rivers and so on, a comment and then a question. I heard, I think it was Howard Hong, quite a few years ago now, at St. Olaf College, and I think it was Howard Hong who built this fireplace, didn't he? Somebody said,
yeah.
And you were there,
yeah.
Holden Village people. You make the statement that we are now living in what he called the eighth day of creation. That we are part of the completion of the creation, of a world that is still not, it is an imperfect world in many ways, and that God has chosen to use our minds and our hands in the completion of creation. And that certainly has risks and dangers. There's a kind of arrogance maybe about that, but a kind of sense of responsibility. We're doing it one way or the other anyway. It's a question whether we do it in an informed, responsible way, or we do it kind of haphazardly. My question is, you made some comments, in addition to commenting the other day about this reversal of rivers, of possibilities of bringing the ocean into Death Valley or into the Dead Sea area. You know, would you say to that?
When we have solved the problem of the hydrogen that will make it small enough so it doesn't create the temperatures, then we can have smaller explosions and make a sea level canal into Death Valley and fill it with water. And I don't know whether you geologists let me do that or not. What would happen if we filled Death Valley with water? It would just ruin the ecology, wouldn't it?
It sure wouldn't be Death Valley.
We could make an inland seaport so you wouldn't have to ship your fruit so far to get it ready to go.
What about the use of salt water?
Yes, there is a man that I know that's working on a filtering system for salt water that can be, he can filter it so that it is about 95% pure and could be used for irrigation purposes just as they get it. These people that are trying to do things have all my support in the world. There's lots of ocean water. Just an awful lot of ocean water. How much of the surface of the earth is covered with ocean? I haven't gotten my geography well in mind, but it seems to me it was 76%. I believe that's right. We got lots of water. Unless we freeze it up in ice and send it screaming down across here, because we run into one of these dust clouds, maybe you could put the dust on the moon. And if we do that, why, we've had it anyway. We will be frozen up within. Well, we'd probably survive, but we'd be taken off to the tropics as fast as we could make it. But good, clean water. Filter the ocean. Make it suitable for irrigation. This is being worked on. Also, we have a Dead Sea in Israel. It's full of wonderful things. It's 600 and some feet below sea level, and they're having a war over water in there because they need it for irrigation. I don't know what would happen if we'd flood the Dead Sea. We could do that way easier. We can do some of these other things if they'd let us. What would happen if the Dead Sea got flooded? Put some water over there. Does it rain where there's water evaporating? Sure does. And why, trees grow.
Why has no one gone into the Dead Sea to get all the minerals that are in there?
They are going in. They're working it very hard. I was hoping they'd get enough of it out so we could flood the Dead Sea and put some water in it. And let's filter it before we put it in and make it go in very nearly fresh. Would be nice, wouldn't it? Let's dream dreams and do greater miracles. And let's seek ways of doing these. Seek and you will find. Knock and it'll be open. Let's keep seeking and knocking and asking and it will be given to you. This I believe so strongly. And greater miracles will you or young men do than you've ever seen before. And some of them are happening all the time. Yes.
The state of South Dakota had a rainmaking, statewide rainmaking program for 4 years, probably the leading project in the nation on a statewide basis. And it was killed the past session by the opponents of it. And of course, one of the main issues was interfering with God's homeland. Of, just like to hear your reaction to it.
My reaction is that I doubt very much that we're going to handle the weather yet. I'm not familiar with rainmaking techniques other than we use silver iodide usually or some kind of...
But the statistics are certain.
Have they increased the rain?
Possibly by an inch over the state, but we've greatly, there's no doubt that we've decreased hail.
Decreased
which is terribly destructive to crops.
Yes, indeed it is.
That is almost irrefutable, but the rainmaking takes many, many years because it can't take a four-year period, then what do you base it on? You know, it takes a long period of time to arrive at meaningful figures.
What percentage increase would that rain be? How much do you normally get?
Across the state, 15 inches. So it's quite a significant increase. The people who are the proponents, you know, come up with hundreds of millions of dollars of benefit to the state from an inch of rain in food products, grain.
It certainly seemed to me that if we could in some ways be partners with God in the work of creation so we could reduce the harmful effects of weather, prevent a tornado, prevent a hailstorm, we could increase rain in areas where it is desperately needed, I think one should have a service of thanksgiving and praise for that.
I think that perhaps it brings up one of the problems that scientific research gets so entangled in the political life. And certainly that must have been what happened in South Dakota.
This was one of the most emotional issues we had. One way to fill the Capitol building with irate heat.
Is there any way to separate the work of the scientists from politics?
Not as long as they need that.
Is that really any different? For example, I mentioned the example of polio in the world. We have our smallpox, or you can go on and on with those that have been virtually eliminated. Is that that meddling with God's creation, as if, you know, sickness is God's will? I don't think we buy that. I don't think we believe that all the doctors are working for healing and working for vaccines or working for a cure of cancer are working against God. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me the same way, if one could in some way have the decrease in the destructive aspects of weather and increase in the benefits of weather, it's a parallel thing for which we praise and thank God.
The issue is not that clear cut, is it?
No.
It seems like it's one thing to use God's creation, to use our minds in the service of God's creation with responsible stewardship. But it's another thing to exploit God's creation as we have done in the past.
Of course, nobody is in favor of exploiting creation, but would you say a particular example like this of increasing rainfall in an area where it's needed, of decreasing hail, but that's exploiting creation? Like we exploit all kinds of ways.
Well, I wouldn't say reversing a river was, but deciding that this species of animal is going to go, that to me is plenty of God.
Well, God took care of this tremendous number of them himself, and he created them to start with. and one reversal of a river is not going to take care of a species.
Well, see, I don't know that. Perhaps you do. But if we do, say there is a species of animals that we know is going to be destroyed by such a thing,
then
we knew all the implications of that destruction, then I guess I'd say okay. But I don't know how we can know all the implications.
Would you trade for the species of one of these animals that you of course a lot of people eat pork and beef and lamb and most of these things and don't think of the fact that we have destroyed a life of an animal to get this? Would you trade this increase in food for the lives of some of the children?
That's not my point. My point is we don't know the ultimate implications.
Oh, I know. I realize that you have a very good point there, and you're absolutely right on it. I would not destroy any of God's creatures under any condition, except I do slap a few mosquitoes. And I have been guilty of poisoning a few rats. And I have seen the people in Nigeria, when they were able to catch a rat, immediately build a fire and eat every smidgen of that rat, including all of it. Cook it and eat it immediately. That's all of the meat and food products that many of them get, is what the rats and the wild things that they can catch.
Well, their choices and all these things are never pure. And Larry was saying what agony it is often to vote on some of these issues. And
I agree.
Doing nothing is also a decision. Indecision is a decision. And there certainly are lots of things. We may well make mistakes. We've made a lot of mistakes. Many mistakes are made with the best intentions. And with everything we may do, we have to say, if this is wrong, God have mercy on me and correct me or do it. But it's, I think somehow that the basic approach to the stewardship of creation is... that's very clear in the witness of Scripture.
Well, a recent TV documentary illustrated our problem in this way, that it's sort of like a chess game. If you open it, you have innumerable ways to open a chess game. In the middle game, you have a lot of options. But at the end game, your options are very few. We're in the middle game right now.
I'm sure we are. We are in the middle game.
We're coming towards the end of it.
And I am as optimistic as I can be that we are going to stay ahead of the game. We're going to win it.
Let's hope so. Pretty good.
Well, I think one of the basic questions, which we obviously can't solve, is whether we try to approach this in a solution way by an energy-intensive approach, or whether we have to come to a labor-intensive approach. That is, we can't go both ways. And from the point of view of the Western world and the industrial world, there is no question, I think, in our minds, if we took a consensus here in the room, we would solve our problems by creating the energy that it takes to solve. China has gone the other way. They have solved, or are trying to solve, their problem from a labor-intensive and a energy, a very minimum use of energy. India is trying to see where it can fit in the picture. Two-thirds of the world really does not have the benefit of the kind of energy that we have to reverse a river or to create rain, you see. All of this is a very energy-intensive kinds of thing. It takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of material. And it's a question of whether the earth can produce the energy and the materials to solve our problems in that way. Now, that's really where the problem is. We have the people, we have more people on the earth today than we can handle if we strictly limit ourselves to a labor-intensive kind of operation. And so we've committed ourselves to use our minds to create energy. And we have made our life pattern what it is because energy is cheap, energy is available. Now it's a question of how long, how many years, how many hundreds of years or thousands of years we can go on with this kind of a program and and still have the materials to do it with. Now, that's simply stating a problem, no answer. But we're a part of the answer. And we have to decide which way we go and how we solve it.
Think of that puzzler. I heard the bell ring. I think we should probably stop here and go get some coffee and think about it. And anytime you want to catch my dad while he's still here until Wednesday, he's an idea man right after the minute, and he's got lots of things he hasn't shared.
Thank you.